Welcome to the Liberty Free to Be podcast. I've had the pleasure of connecting with women from all over the world, and I'm constantly left feeling uplifted by their stories, their attitude and zest for life. Whenever I'm having a wobble, they've been a great source of encouragement. So I wanted to create a space to not only share their stories and amplify women over 40's voices, but also share my own passion for living a fulfilled life with freedom. Join me as I share a fortnightly dose of midlife motivation, where you get to hear from some amazing people who are leaving a trail of inspiration along the way, breaking down midlife stereotypical barriers, and proving it's never too late to find new passion and purpose. Think of it as your one-stop shop full of real stories you can relate to, lifestyle inspiration, practical resources from health and wealth, mindset to menopause, reinvention to rebellion. No subject is off limits. Living a life of liberty, free to be, whatever we want to be in midlife and beyond.
So welcome back to a new week on Liberty Free to Be. I hope you've had a great fortnight. I am loving being back talking to some amazing women, and today is no exception. So today I am talking to T. Gray. And T, for me, we will find out lots more about her, but it's really the epitome of why we should have older women's voices in the fashion industry, because there's so much lived experience and so much passion for the industry. We need to have these voices heard and seen. So I can't wait to find out more, particularly as I have a real love for vintage fashion. So we've got a lot to talk about. So welcome, T.
Hi, Rachel, the wonderful Rachel Peru.
This is so lovely. We've been talking about having this conversation for a long time. So
yeah,
I have to finally sit down and get together. And I must say that we're in the most amazing shop today, which we're talking about, but we're in the Trad Collective in Leeds. And it's the perfect setting for us to talk about sustainable fashion, vintage, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I hail from Yorkshire. A place that is known for tailoring and wool has had a historic connection to the industry. In fact, up until the 60s, it was the epicentre of tailoring, a place where Mr. Marx met Mr. Spencer, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah.
Montagu Burton, about 15 minutes from this store, employed 10,000 people in what became, as we know it more in the modern era, Topshop. So Leeds, you know, has always had a feel for fashion and clothing.
Yeah.
And I worked across the road. This store, Trad Collective, it's amazing. It sells some pre-owned and lots of sustainable pieces. And in fact, in the late 70s, my Saturday job was just across the road at a place which is now the very upmarket Victoria Quarter. It wasn't quite so upmarket then. But it was a shop that was in one of the lovely arcades, County Arcade, with all the lovely
tiles. That's one of my
favourites. Oh,
yeah.
And they used to sell all those sort of uniforms and workwear, denim. So in the late 70s, when I was a bit of a funky punk, we used to have a sort of passion for those kind of different styles of jeans. Now, a lot of the designers, such as Fiorucci, were using the workwear style where you had a ruler pocket.
Yes.
So if you're on a bit of a budget, you could go to Army and Navy stores or places like Castitia and actually buy dungarees and reappropriate them.
Yeah.
Which is what people do today. You could style them up. And so on a Saturday afternoon on Vicar Lane, we used to get a whole heap of students just piling into the basement at Castitia, trying on all the jeans. So it's great fun. And that was working in the late 70s on Vicar Lane in Leeds, just literally 5 minutes across the road from where we're sitting.
So you had that passion for fashion at a very young age.
Oh,
so but you did actually train as a psychiatric nurse.
Oh, yeah.
So how did you go from that, merging that into moving to London and being really at the heart of the London underground fashion scene in the 80s?
Yeah, well, what happened was my mum was a nurse, and like all good mums, she said, you know, it's okay wanting to do all these fashion and art things, which I did. She said, but, you know, you're not going to be able to earn any money at that. You've got to get a proper job or a proper trade under your belt. So my mum was a nurse, so I trained as a nurse. I mean, it probably broke her heart that I actually did psychiatric nursing, because she was probably expecting the rebellious streak, because it was punk at the time that was the thing. thing.
Yeah.
She was probably expecting me to wear a uniform and kind of settle down and become a little bit more what she might envisage as, you know, a good girl.
Yeah.
But that wasn't to be in the nicest possible way. So unfortunately for her, I was a psychiatric nurse. I must have ticked that box on the form, you know. And I trained at St. James's, which is a very big teaching hospital over in Hare Hills. And it was very trendy lefty, and we didn't wear uniforms.
Right.
We were some of the early units that didn't wear uniforms. So as you can imagine, that was a bit more freestyle than my mum anticipated. So that only added to the rebellion. And there was some really interesting lessons to learn there. And the psychology you obviously have to absorb when you're working in psychological medicine, and all the group work and all the sort of things that you do working with art therapists and movement therapists. When you work through talk therapies like that, you learn so much and you learn about yourself. And then, lo and behold, when I then moved down to London in the mid-80s, you know, with a big mass exodus of groovy people who left Leeds at the time, because it's probably hard to envisage, but you just couldn't get the jobs in the media or the creative industries in the north, whatever.
Well, there's north-south divide, but back then it was even...
Oh, it was much more exacerbated. So a lot of us moved down to London to try our hand, you know, because we'd heard about the streets being paved with gold. No, I'm only kidding. We went down there because we thought we'd been reading The Face and ID magazine, and it all seemed to be happening down there. And it was. Indeed, it was. So a lot of us moved down to London in the mid-80s. I mean, there'd been the miners' strike as well, and that had really affected a lot of people in Yorkshire. So there was a sense that everything was happening elsewhere.
Yeah.
Although there'd been so many seminal clubs up north. I mean, in Leeds, we had The Warehouse.
The Warehouse was amazing.
Oh, wow.
It was only a tail end of The Warehouse before it closed.
Yeah. And it was like our answer to Studio 54.
Yeah.
And then there'd been a lot of fantastic clubs like The Central, which was a soul club. I'm still in touch with lots of people at The Central today, and amazing DJs. So there was a lot of style here and a lot of creativity. But in terms of actually earning a living at that, it was questionable, as indeed it can still be today.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I can vouch for that.
Edmund Lowe. So I went down to London. And the psychiatric nurse skills, believe you me, served me very well in Metropolis, because you meet so many different types of people. So it was handy to have an empathy and understanding of all these different types of people that I met that might not have been on my radar in Yorkshire. And so when I came to London, I got involved. I went clubbing straight away. The first job I got was actually at Joseph on Sloane Street, which was one of the flagship Joseph stores.
Nice.
Oh, it was lovely. And it sold Catherine Hamner, Jean-Paul Gaultier, and the rest, and early John Galliano. I mean, it was just a gorgeous emporium.
Yeah.
And everybody looked amazing that worked there. So I felt, wow, I walked in and got a job there when I just sort of packed in the psychiatric nursing. But what I found was I was able later on, which we'll come to that, to transfer those skills, because in marketing and publicity and PR, it's all about the psychology and sociology, and all the ologies are very helpful. So I found I had quite a lot more transferable skills than I had first anticipated.
I think that's one thing that women quite often underestimate themselves, those transferable skills. And they think they can't change career paths because they've only been doing this one regimented job. But actually, if they really look to their skill sets of what they've done, it can carry forward into so many different areas, can't it?
Oh, yeah. And in today's world, almost the gig economy, the way that things have rolled and panned out, there's very few jobs that are there for a very long time as they once were.
Yeah.
So I think we've all had to adjust our expectations. And I think I saw a book once, I don't know who it's by, years ago, called What Colour Is Your Parachute? And that had already predicted how we might often reinvent ourselves in the workplace. I mean, honestly, reinvention in fashion is de rigueur.
Yeah.
It is just, you know, what it is. But in the workplace, a lot of people have had to sort of see themselves in many different roles in order to sustain a career.
Yeah.
So early on, I had that lesson. And so I transferred a lot of the skills and people skills that I'd learned and being able to exercise, I transferred them into another realm.
What was it like in that underground kind of London scene of the fashion industry? Because it had such a big impact on society that I don't think we see today. So it's not the same. But what was London like back then in that area?
Oh, man. It was incredible. It was, for example, by day you might be standing in a posh boutique and serving a pop star, and they all used to come in because there was a big reinvigoration of the music industry, of course, with the Indian electronic scene. So you might be serving a pop star, and then it was the early days of the MTV era when suddenly image consciousness became much more of a thing again to match it with the music. So you would be standing by day potentially in a boutique, and then at night we'd go to clubs such as Taboo, which is run by a performance artist called Lee Bowery, and he was a living work of art. I mean, he wore these outrageous outfits and he made himself noticeable. And so the club that he ran had a door policy. You quite simply could not get in there if you were a bit too pedestrian, a bit non-core, that they weren't having it. So that was almost like following on from the New Romantic era and the club kids, people like Boy George. Well, Boy George went to Taboo and was friends with Lee Bowery.
Did that make you raise your game in terms of kind of how far you would experiment with your own fashion then?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in Leeds, I think I'd been pretty outrageous. I was lucky enough to be around enough people that also did that. So we kind of had each other a little bit. We had each other's backs because you could risk quite a lot at one point in Leeds by being two out there. So probably in lots of other places too. But when in London, obviously, there was this vibe that anything goes. And so it did. But it was nice because there was a lot of individuality and lots of designers coming up. I actually ended up styling quite a lot of upcoming bands and artists because people noticed I had a flair for it.
Yeah. So is that how that kind of started then, that the styling and the whole kind of fashion creating, that's how it started?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd had a brief spell in a goth band in Leeds.
What did you?
Yeah, we were called Reptile House.
Right.
But I must stress, we
were... Do you want footage of that, T?
You know, I wish there was. Yeah. I wish there was. There's somewhere, there's an EP floating about. But at that time, in the mid-80s, Leeds became very goth as a reference perhaps to Whitby and Dracula,
yes,
and all the sort of dark and grim times that might have gone on before. So we had a kind of goth sensibility. So with the indie side, when I first went down to London, I brought a bit of the goth sensibility with me, as well as, you know, all the different street styles. And so some of the bands that I initially worked with when we did the MTV sort of promo era were, for one, Fields of Nephilim.
Right.
I worked on a video promo for them with a cult horror film director. Also, I was lucky enough to be taken on by a makeup artist as her assistant for a short while. I was juggling this, you know, with lots of other things, seeing where I could sort of make my move or make my mark. And these things are, you know, like acting, they can be a bit sporadic.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was very lucky. I managed to work on a few really interesting promos. So, for example, when I was assisting the makeup artist, Prue, she was a lovely lady. She gave me lots of opportunities. One of my first promos was with AmaZulu.
Right.
And they were kind of like, a bit like Jenny Bellstar. They were kind of, they had dreadlocks, a kind of Rastafarian look. And they were a female band. Excuse me. And they did a lot of, they did a few covers and they were on Island Records. And they were directed at the time by an ex-member of Eurythmics, fabulous filmmaker and producer called Roger Pomfrey, RIP. And he was a very open-minded, lovely person to work with. So I found things were opening out down there because it was the start of the MTV era.
Yeah.
And at that time, a lot of the bands and their labels were based in London. So yes, it was London-centric. Mm. So the energy from the streets and the club and the scenes, you know, the different, shall we say, youth movements,
yeah,
was another thing that was transferable if you had a flair for it into styling and makeup and making images, you know, offering that, offering to sort of make a unified visual image for a band that was trying to break through.
I love that idea of how you've got, I mean, you've got creativity running through your veins, clearly, but I love how you have just opened your mind to all sorts of opportunities so that you've not been put in a box and said, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to try lots of different things. I think we could all learn from that, because I think sometimes we do get told by our parents, from especially our generation, we were taught to go out of school, find one job, stick at it, that's your job for life. Whereas you've had lots of different experiences that have got you to where you are now with your own True Street Creators brand. And because you've been open-minded about stuff.
Yeah, I think that it's an essential component, really, to, shall we say, meeting the challenges of the workplace, to try and stay open. It is a real job at times to do that when we all get setbacks, as we all inevitably do.
Yeah.
But if you keep an open mind, I think it can serve you into the next incarnation, or and sometimes you can just see the little sort of shoots of an idea that will reach fruition at another point in time.
Yeah.
So I think it is always kind of wise to sort of stay open to possibilities, especially when you're in fashion and the creative realm, because it changes so much.
Yes.
It's the visuals and aesthetics change so much. I mean, and we'll come to that because, as we know, it changes so much. So we've ended up with so much product through fast fashion, making that very cheap. And some of the production methods have been questionable for the planet and for the people and slightly unethical. But the ideas don't need to slow down.
No.
Perhaps just the execution of the ideas needs to have a little bit of a retweak.
And before I move on to that, because one of the things I really want to talk about is, because you have shot with my absolute favourite photographer, who I would absolutely love to shoot with, Rankin. Well, how did that come about? Before we leave London, how did that come about?
Well, Rankin, there was an initiative by the legend that is Karen Franklin. And she used to host the Clothes Show, and she worked for ID magazine. A very interesting person who has always had inclusivity at the heart of her styling and her practices. And she brought about an initiative around 2009 at London Fashion Week called Everybody Counts. Now, Erin O'Connor, the supermodel, and others jumped on board with that. And Rankin did. And they brought an initiative to London Fashion Week with Everybody Counts, whereby they were trying to encourage inclusive casting. And by that, I mean, it seems like almost like so regular to see that today, but it wasn't then. It was really breaking new ground. Mm. So they were showing different body shapes, which seems like something that you should do if you're a maker.
Yeah.
And lots of designers at the time were trying to embrace curvature, because a lot of the supermodels perhaps were less curvy than other women who are equally as fabulous. Yeah. Case in point, Rachel Peru. So Rankin got on board with that. And I went to London Fashion Week, as I often did, chatting to upcoming designers and doing small projects. And I was snapped there. And so I always remembered that Rankin had championed Everybody Counts and has done a lot of work since to cast inclusively.
Yes.
So fast forward to last year, and I was sort of needing some shots for my True Street Curators, my pre-owned and pre-loved curation of goods and things. I saw that Rankin was opening up his studio to doing shots, like street casting almost, which I love, by the way. That is something I do. I love street casting because that is how you get people who are unusual and you know, that capture your imagination. So I thought, oh, wow, I've got to do this. So I sort of emailed and filled out you know, the booking form. There was a small charge, but it was a fraction of what these sort of things would normally cost. So, you know, I hopped on the train and went down there against all the odds.
It's amazing.
Thank you. And, so I'm now part of the Rankin Archive. I was very happy with the shots. And that was a big part of being positive about midlife as well, about trying to show myself as being equally as worthy today as when I was a gorgeous young thing running around.
Anyway, because you've got that lived in experience and knowledge to share with others and to pass down to the next generation as well.
Yeah. Well, I really like the way that with the pro-aging, I mean, we don't always have to give it a name, but with the more pro-aging movement, I really like the way that photographers and brands have now started to reciprocate what we've all known for a long time, that we just can't live up to some of these idealized standards that are brought about by photographic trickery at times. Yeah. And fantastic though they are, if that brings about a feeling that I am not worthy, then that's not a good thing.
No,
so I felt that to put a lovely picture of myself out there, you know, I don't have kids, but I'm from a very big extended family. I do have nieces and nephews and great nieces that are going to be following on. And I just wanted them to know it's okay.
Yeah.
This is what it looks like.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're still relevant and you're still doing all the things that that bring you joy. And if anything, you've leveled up and you've dialed that notch higher because you've got that freedom to say, well, fuck it, I'm going to do what I want to do, actually. I'm not responsible to please anybody else in society. It's about what you want to do. I think that comes with age, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, because you realise that this is a privilege. To mature is a privilege, because after all, we will all, by this point in life, have encountered bereavement. And for some people, they simply will not have the privilege of aging. So it's a gift. The present is a gift. It's called the present, and the present is a present.
Yeah.
It's a gift. So if you accept the challenge and the adventure of life, and you have the privilege to mature and age, then it'd be pretty rude, wouldn't it, to sort of like throw that away.
Absolutely.
Because I always feel, even if you have no, you don't have to be religious, but if you have a philosophy that it is a gift, I feel it's a constructive way to see it.
Yes.
That there's a reason, you know, you're here, you've got breath in you, there's more adventures around the corner, clearly.
Yes.
Otherwise you wouldn't be here. And that's what you've got to remember. Some people did not have the privilege of reaching this point in life. So, yeah.
You are doing things that bring you joy. True Street Creators. And we've got the shared passion for vintage, pre-loved. I grew up with charity shops and jumble sales. And you really have got this passion for it. But what I love about you is you're not saying that fashion's no good, and that, because you do have a respect for the fashion industry, but that there needs to be changes because it's not sustainable and it's not doing the environment any good whatsoever. So how does that balance out, and what do you think is the best way forward?
Well, how I see it is I've always reconciled myself to artisanal craftsmanship, which is generally a slower process in terms of making than some of the more what I call vulgar disposable models of making and making things so fast and cheap that they're almost not valued and thrown away.
Yeah.
And indeed they are. And very often it's the global south that has to clean up our mess at this end, because a lot of goods that aren't sold, even in the charity shops, end up somewhere where they're just not going to easily decompose. There's a lot of fossil fuels involved in some of the man-made fibres that they're made of, and all the zips and fasteners and things like that. What a waste of resources. So I like to reconcile myself with the more ethical side of fashion, where I know that a maker has taken the trouble to source their materials as best they can sustainably. Someone that has considered the planet, at least considered it, and more than that, if possible, and shown empathy, where possible, used artisanal skills that might be something that we might treasure. You know, like with the wool, the heritage of Yorkshire and the wool.
Yes.
at one time, if you bought a suit, like our grandparents or great grandparents, that suit lasted for a very long time and it was cherished and brought out special occasions, weddings, funerals, all of that.
Yeah.
So I felt that, I use the word vulgar, I think that unwittingly we'd walked into, because I was born mid-century, so unwittingly we'd walked into a very vulgar ethos where everything's disposable. And unfortunately now the planet has said no more.
Yeah.
Well, fortunately, Mother Earth has said no more, and climate scientists are unequivocal that the way that we can go about changing the dilemma we find ourselves in is to be more conscious in our consumption. And if we are going to make something, and it's not just nice to have, these are laws now, far-reaching laws about sustainability that are coming into being in the UK and the EU. So we've got to now look at what is the purpose of that item. And that goes for everything, furniture, white goods, who's going to dispose of it at its end of life? And can we prolong that life cycle? And the UN have even said it, and organisations such as Ellen MacArthur Foundation. So they're looking at now what becomes of all these things, all this stuff that we have. So if we look at that, then we have to look at how long that thing's going to last. So that's where I like high fashion. It doesn't always get it right, but sometimes I believe that high fashion is because it has that bit more brevity and budget to be able to pay for expensive fabrics. It's also got the opportunity, hopefully, to be more artisanal and ethical and desirable, because desirability is a big deal. And even Vivienne Westwood talked about this. So if it's desirable, it's more likely, I believe, that you will want to keep it for a longer amount of time.
Yeah.
So that's where I can reconcile myself with some of the high fashion. And when I am able to afford it, it's not every day. So that's another way that it slows it down. When I'm able to afford it, I see it as an investment piece.
Yeah.
And I believe a lot of the millennials and Gen Z, I'm told, and research backs this up, that they will, apart from pre-owned, they'll often invest.
Yeah.
In newer things that are well made, that are ethically sourced and desirable to them and chime with their values. Or indeed, they might really like, same as I might, if I could afford it, a fabulous piece of couture, a Chanel bag or something.
Yeah.
So, and I like it at the moment that you can see that people are repairing again.
I was going to say that, because we're obviously in a trad collective, and as well as it being a great place for sustainable fashion and pre-loved, they also have a repair place where you can have things altered, and we need to get back into that. You know, I grew up, my grandma was a seamstress, so she would change things if things grew. If, you know, I had a long tartan maxi dress in the 1970s, that was our Christmas Day outfit. Me and my sister had matching. But as I grew taller, it got shorter and shorter, and she just raised the hems. Whereas now, we would just buy a new outfit every occasion. And do you think we are going back to that, getting back to people readapting their clothes, reworking their clothes to last longer?
Yes, absolutely, because these are recommended techniques. These are recommended ways in which we can address climate change by prolonging the life, the cycle of all things. So that might mean it might be new to you, but it might have been altered, redesigned, reimagined, reworked, and so it goes. It'll be cyclical.
Yeah.
That's the circular economy at its best. And some things may not resemble what they originally looked like. I mean, sure, you're not going to necessarily deconstruct a fabulous Chanel jacket from 1966. You might just preserve it as is. But there's other things that might have been a little bit more affordable at the time, but equally sort of interesting as a garment, that will be deconstructed. And I always actually loved, there was a movement of design, the deconstructionists in the early 90s.
Yeah.
People like Martin Margiely and Dries Van Noten, who actually, as we came out of the power dressing 80s with the shoulder pads and designer things into the more grungy and sort of early 90s, they softened the shoulders and made sort of frayed hems and frayed detailing and sort of age detailing a thing. And they brought that into vogue, and some of the clothes looked like you might have bought them at a flea market. Well, so you can do both and still look high fashion. So in answer to your original question is, I think both can happily coexist as long as the considerations as to what is to become of these garments is taken seriously. And it will be because it is now ensconced in law.
Yeah, that's really good news.
Yeah, and there are cases being taken against brands that don't seem to be showing the considerations that we need now we understand the climate emergency better.
Yeah.
And they are being taken to task.
Good.
And sometimes the consumers are rejecting it. But then you've got to look, some of the big sports brands, I've seen the most incredibly upcycled pieces from football strips.
Yeah.
Designers like Nicole McLaughlin working with Nike are making out of footballs and making it look like a backpack that could easily live in a couture environment.
Yeah.
And then equally, you'll go into such as Re-Selfridges, and Selfridges have made a big impact, I think, in the world of retail by embracing the era that we're in and looking to offer repair.
Yeah.
And rework.
Yeah.
So it's integral. Yeah. I mean, my husband had an old work suit, but it was from Marks and Spencer, actually, the Autograph range. And it was just the most exquisite wool. Just the fabric alone was gorgeous, but it had got a bit tired, a bit overworn. So we took it to a designer at the time down in Doncaster, and we took an old shirt, and she actually chopped up the shirt, and she made all these sort of little statement sleeves down the side of the trouser, and it started to look better distressed.
Yeah.
So it was no longer a sort of pristine work suit, because he has to wear that type of thing for work.
Yeah.
It became a much more casual suit, and then she sort of patched up elements that had started to wear with all these little pieces from a shirt that was worn out. And it is a completely unique garment now.
Yeah.
It is a one-off.
That's the beauty of it. That's what I love, is knowing that you're going to walk out the door in an outfit that nobody else is wearing, and an outfit that brings you joy. And I know that's what you're all about, is making and bringing joy and fun back into your wardrobe.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, so you could equally mix that. I mean, I could possibly get away with that suit with a belt and, you know, a different type of shoe. And you can mend your trainers more easily now, because trainers were a big problem for the environment. So now I've really enjoyed seeing some of the artistry in the street kind of crews when they sort of paint trainers. And now designers even mirror that back, because the street feeds up to the catwalk and the catwalk feeds the street. And they're sort of symbiotic things,
yeah,
which is a really interesting way to communicate. Because clothes, apart from protecting us, keeping us warm or cool, we've always known they have a powerful communicative value. You know, that we have symbolic garments for different events, or we're communicating something about ourselves. And it's their go-to. Like, I have a coat that I bought in 1986 when I worked on Bond Street at Midas. And it was literally a month's wages. And it was just, at the time, felt like the silliest thing I'd ever done. You know, risk not having my rent that month.
Sometimes some happens in wool.
It's wool gabardine. You see how obsessed I am?
Yeah.
It was wool, bottle green wool gabardine. And I kid you not, I wore it in a little film I made about my brand last year with some filmmakers in York, Carrillo. And they found it hilarious. They were born the year that I bought that coat. So I was telling them the story. And that's the other thing. Things that are not new or that are upcycled, they all have a provenance.
Yes.
And we're increasingly being asked to question the provenance. That's what ethical consumerism is about, trying to put pressure on makers and producers to do the right thing where they can.
Mm.
You know, try and make the right choices for us,
yeah,
on our behalf. So when I was telling them the provenance of the coat, you know, it was hilarious to them,
yeah,
that I was still wearing that coat. And the other little thing, another little side story about that, round the corner from the boutique where I was working was the Anthony Doffé Gallery. Now, at that time, Andy Warhol was still alive, still with us. And he came to London, 86, 87, and he did an exhibition there called I'm Art, Buy Me, you know, because he had quite a sense of humour.
Yeah.
And there were some fairly affordable pieces of art in that exhibition. And I went round there and I was toying with should I, shouldn't I, because, you know, everyone has to pay the rent and buy the groceries. And of course, I was a bit stretched. And then I bought the coat instead of the Andy Warhol.
Right.
Now, if I bought the Andy Warhol, I would have had the deposit for a flat a lot sooner.
Yes.
Let's just say that. Yeah. So I'm not saying it was a complete mistake, but I am still wearing the coat.
Yeah. It's not about that pension.
So it's always a story, you know, when you start to sort of be more considered in your choices. It's much more charming as a means of sort of giving yourself a boost with retail therapy. It's way more charming than just sort of like, almost like fast food, consume, 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 and you're hungry again an hour later.
Yeah.
You know.
I love that. Do you think that now you're back in the north and you're back in Leeds, and do you think that there is this north-south divide as much as there was back then, or do you think it has changed? As a model, from my perspective, I do still feel there's this big divide in the fashion industry, because all my work's in London. It's very rarely I get booked for a job in the north. But there is clearly a big creative vibe going on around here. So do you think there is still a kind of north-south divide?
I suppose my optimism at times skims over it, because I did find acceptance in London. Mm. Even though I'm from the north, I did mix in and I didn't make too big a deal of being from the north.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that's right or wrong, and everyone's free to their own way of being.
Mm.
So when I was down there, I got the occasional joke, you know, where's your whippets and e-buy gum and eckythump. I got the occasional cliche, but I've very quickly sort of moved on from that by sort of not dwelling on it. Mm. I certainly didn't play up to it, because I'm quite posh these days. I mean, you know, not exactly hyacinth bouquet, but, you know, my telephone voice is now my day voice as well. So I didn't have too many sort of overly overt characteristics that someone could be nasty about.
Mm.
But not that there's anything wrong if you do. So for me, I blended in. So I suppose you've had that sort of euphoria of thinking that perhaps I minimise the north-south divide a little bit.
Mm.
I've chosen to kind of slightly overlook it.
Yeah.
So that I can move on. But yeah, there's clearly still a big fashion and media industry that is London-centric. Mm. And London as a fashion capital on the global stage is very well respected for ideas. Perhaps we haven't invested in regional areas for their fashion content for whatever reasons, although the North is known for artisanal skills, and still there's some very big mills that supply with exquisite fabrics, might I add, and royal warrants that supply some of the big couture houses.
Yeah.
But that's sort of very much white labelled behind the scenes to a point, unless you're in the industry.
Yeah.
But it's equally fed by lots and lots of professionals and creatives who come from different parts of the country, including the North.
Yeah.
You know, and some really influential designers. Well, look, you've got Paul Smith from Nottingham.
Yes.
Dame Vivienne Westwood was, of course, from Derbyshire.
Yeah.
So, you know, they do come from different parts of the country. But as much as they may have had a heritage in textiles, I mean, for example, Nottingham was lace since sort of medieval times almost, and Northamptonshire leather, where you get lots of beautiful men's shoes. Yorkshire was tailoring and wool. You have those heritage bases, and then some of the art colleges feed into the big London colleges, such as Central St Martin's and the Royal College. So it maintains its London-centric side. So to some extent, it's difficult to not have a bit of a divide where the opportunities lie on the prestige side, i.e. It's where London Fashion Week is. Of course, it's going to be in London. Yeah. But I've noticed, you know, we have York Fashion Week now.
Yeah, which I think it's growing. And it is growing year on year, which is exciting. And I think having creatives like yourself back in Yorkshire is got to be a good thing, that there is this movement that we are kind of building our own fashion community.
Yeah.
So we don't have to compete with London, but we could still be part of the conversation.
Yeah,
that is really important. Yeah. I think it's exciting. I think it's an exciting time, actually, to be in. I think it'd be interesting to see what happens in the next few years.
Yeah, absolutely, it is. Yeah,
honestly, I could talk to you for hours. It's very interesting, and you've got such a breadth of knowledge about the whole industry. I find it fascinating. So thank you so much for sharing just a little part of it with me. The last two questions that I ask all my guests, because I really want to encourage women to compliment themselves more, because from a young age, we're taught not to brag, not to talk about all the good positive things, because it's seen as being bragging and it's showing off. But actually, we should celebrate our strengths more. So if you were to pay yourself a compliment, what would it be?
I think I'd say you're good-hearted. I'd say, T, you show up and you've got your heart in the right place. Now, as we all know, life has many lessons for us to learn. It doesn't always work out,
yeah.
But I keep showing up and I know I've got a good heart.
Mm.
And Fergal Sharkey, who was a punk and did a single when he went solo years ago called A Good Heart,
yeah.
These days is hard to find. Now, he is actually cleaning up our waterways.
Yeah, he's doing a great job.
He's doing a great job of campaigning to get our waterways cleaner. So I always liked his song, A Good Heart These Days is Hard to Find. So I always find that good-heartedness, even if you're not perfect or things go awry,
yeah,
if you know someone's heart's in the right place, it's much easier to forgive them.
Yeah.
So that's what I'd pay myself the compliment of saying, well, you were good-hearted. You tried.
Yeah. Love that. Keep going. Thank you. And my last question I ask all my guests, liberty free to be, what does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, I think it's a beautiful concept. I love the name that you've given your concept, your podcast and your channel. What I see it as is being healthy. And that's mind, body, soul. You're nothing without your health. I mean, you know, it's a cliche, but your health is your wealth.
Mm.
So if you feel healthy, I think that's what freedom is to me. Being healthy, having a healthy mind, body, soul.
Yeah.
If there's something up, which there inevitably will be at some point for all of us, always get it checked out.
Mm.
Yeah, don't dilly-dally. Try and get down to a doctor's. If you're not working out with someone, sit and talk. Get counselling. If it's not right for you, go your separate ways. You're entitled to happiness.
Yes.
You know, I'm a second or third or fourth time around. You know, I'm now married to a man that I married in later years, and we have a great relationship. I probably wasn't the best partner when I was younger.
Yeah.
So I just mean, have a healthy outlook and, you know, be free in your mindset to look at getting to a healthy point.
Mm.
So freedom for me has been healthy, healthy attitude, forgiveness towards yourself if you muck up here and there in the workplace, in relationships with your kids. As long as you then reach out and say to yourself, well, I'll get help for that, or I'll talk to someone,
yeah,
or we'll go forward from here, I think you stand a fighting chance. So for me, liberty to be free is being healthy, mind, body, soul.
Lovely, thank you. And how can people find you on social media?
Oh, wow. Well, I'm at True Street Curators, which is my brand, yeah, of circular economy, pre-owned fabulousness. And that is stocked at the Red House in York. And I have a little splash of it here in the Fabulous Trad Collective, a bit of mid-century jewellery. So, you know, no rules styling. True Street Curators, that's the brand, because we're all curators.
Yeah.
We no longer just live in museums. We all curate our own life, our own art, our own look. So people can find me at True Street Curators on Insta. It is a private account, but your name will be on the door, because I will absolutely like the look of you. I just know it, and let you in. And then I'm on X, formerly Twitter, and that is at True Muse 1.
Lovely. So those handles on the note.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure to catch up with you today.
Thank you so much. Likewise. Lovely. Lovely to meet you.
This has been an absolute joy talking to T, and I hope you've enjoyed the conversation as much as I have. Lots of takeaway points to think about here, but I really hope that that has left you with inspiration to look at your life and make sure that you fill it with the things that bring you joy, that you are more conscious about the clothes that you're wearing and the backstory to them, and that you really live a creative life that fills you with what you need. So thank you, T, and I'll be back in a fortnight, but in the meantime, keep being fabulous.
Thank you for listening to the Liberty Free to Be podcast. I hope it's left you feeling inspired. If it has, why not join the free Liberty Lifestyle Hub over on Facebook? With over 300 women all at different stages of midlife, making new connections and supporting one another. Don't forget to come and say hello at Liberty Free to Be on Instagram. I'd love to know what free to be means to you. If you're loving the podcast, don't forget to subscribe, rate and leave a review. Your support is much appreciated. I'll be back in a fortnight, but in the meantime,